Patrick Henningsen and TNT.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Patrick today, Friday the 26th of April. We're going to do a hard pivot now all the way across the Atlantic to the New York City, amongst other places, because Donald Trump is in court again. And I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Michael Berry, a former director of America First Policy, to help me unpick the legal wrangles. We heard Jonathan Turley in the headlines there saying that the case is collapsing under its own weight and the presumptive Republican nominee may yet get out of this entirely fabricated, politically driven series of prosecutions shining and not in jail as his Democrat detractors would wish. Welcome to the program, Michael. Do you think I'm on the right lines there, that Trump is going to get away with a rap on the knuckles, or indeed nothing at all, vindication? This might all backfire on those trying to prosecute him, mightn't it?
I think if there's any notion of justice in America, that he shouldn't even get a rap on the knuckles. You know, I mean, he should be allowed to walk out of that courthouse and move on with his life and on with the campaign, which I think is where the majority of Americans want to see him. Look, you know, here in America, we're hearing a lot of people who say that even if they don't necessarily support Donald Trump, they would at least like it to be a fair fight. And all of these cases that he's facing, especially this one in New York, you know, people are really quickly coming to the conclusion, the correct conclusion, I would add, that it hasn't been a fair fight to begin with. You know, the deck has been stacked against him. The judge is clearly not impartial, which judges are supposed to be. The prosecutor has already, you know, ran on a campaign that he's going to try to get Trump, as did New York's attorney general. And I dare say it would be almost impossible to find an impartial jury in Manhattan as well. And then you add on top of that the gag order, and it's just one thing after another. So as Jonathan Turley, who is a respected legal mind in his own right, as he said, the case is quickly collapsing under its own weight.
In a post he's just published on Truth Social, the former president has once again demanded Judge Juan Merchan lift the gag order. This was written in the third person, unusually. I'm going to read it out, Michael. 45th President Donald J. Trump is again the Republican nominee for President of the United States and is currently dominating in the polls. However, he is being inundated by the media with questions because of this rigged Biden trial, which President Trump is not allowed to comment on or answer because of Judge Juan Merchan's unprecedented, unconstitutional gag order. Who is Judge Juan Merchan, Michael? Can you enlighten our listeners, please?
Well, he's the trial judge in this case. He's the one that is, you know, there in Manhattan. He is supposed to be a fair, impartial, and objective arbiter, and simply to apply the law to the facts. But as President Trump and many others have pointed out, you know, this gag order is, you know, it's unconstitutional. It's unprecedented because, look, you know, as an attorney, I'm familiar with gag orders and how they're supposed to work. Typically, a gag order would be applied to all of the parties in the court. It's basically a do not talk about this case, you know, because you don't want to reveal something sensitive, something confidential, or, you know, and create unnecessary sensationalizing about the facts of the case. But to have a gag order applied to only one party, and especially, right, in a system of justice where you have the presumption of innocence, and to say the only person this gag order applies to is the defendant and his lawyers, that's, I mean, it just defies common sense, it defies logic, and it defies the Constitution.
I couldn't agree with you more. Does Trump enjoy the support of the whole Republican Party in this battle, or are some of the rhinos trying to use it to undermine him?
Oh, I'm sure there are certainly, you know, probably some, right, in every camp, you know, who, for whatever reason, don't like Donald Trump, and obviously that's their freedom and choice in America. But I think the majority of people in this country, regardless of what side of the political spectrum you're on, I think they see what's happening, not just in New York, but in the Supreme Court, right, in Washington, D.C., in Florida, in Georgia, and elsewhere. Because look, here's the other thing. Obviously it is Donald Trump who's on trial in these cases, but they're now expanding that. And they're going after his lawyers, right? They're going in Arizona. The members of President Trump's legal team, who were simply doing their jobs, right, to represent their client, you know, they've now found themselves under a grand jury indictment. And Arizona is far from the only state where that's happened. So it's not just President Trump himself who's finding himself in the crosshairs, but it's now, you know, lawyers who are simply doing their job, doing their duty as lawyers to represent their clients. And the American people, I suspect very, very quickly, they're going to say enough is enough, right? That if we're going to have any respect for the Constitution and the rule of law in this country, we've got to stop doing this. We've got to stop weaponizing the justice system. We use this term two-tier system of justice, and people say, what does that mean? It's exactly what you see, which is there are certain rules for some people, but those rules don't apply to others.
During the 2020 United States presidential campaign, it's emerged that Judge Juan Merchan donated $15 to Joe Biden's campaign, $10 to the Progressive Turnout Project, and $10 to Stop Republicans, which is a subsidiary of the Progressive Turnout Project. Surely, although very small, those donations should disqualify him from presiding in a case as political as this one.
Yeah, you know, for people when they say, oh, it was only $15. I mean, my question is, okay, what amount of money would it take for him to donate for you to say, oh, that's probably too much, right? I mean, it's one penny. You know, if you donate one penny, then I think you have an obligation as a judge to disclose that, first of all, and then second, to entertain a recusal motion. If the counsel for the other side says, look, you've donated to my opponent in this case, because we all know this is really, you know, a proxy for Joe Biden. And so then the judge in this case, Juan Merchan, and not to mention the fact that his daughter, right, is a known Democrat operative as well, then I do think he has an obligation to recuse himself. And the fact that he hasn't just further shows how biased he is.
Is there no mechanism by which Trump's legal team can challenge his appointment in the case? Is there no sort of higher court they can appeal to and say, look, this guy's obviously going to be biased? What about the Supreme Court of the state of New York?
Yeah, and ironically and very confusingly, the New York legal system uses unusual nomenclature. So in New York, the Supreme Court is actually a lower level court. So when people say, oh, just take it to the New York Supreme Court, they're actually referring to the highest court in New York, which is the Court of Appeals. And so there certainly is the possibility for that to happen. But New York is fairly known to be a far left leaning state, or at least in the urban area, such as New York City. Once you actually leave New York City, New York's actually quite nice and the people are lovely. But yes, there is the potential to appeal this. And you could look, there is even the possibility of appealing this to the United States Supreme Court, because state decisions, once you kind of reach the end of the road in the state system, depending on the circumstances, you do potentially have the opportunity to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And we just heard oral argument in the other case, or one of the other cases against President Trump in the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday. And I actually think I'm cautiously optimistic about the outcome of that case. Of course, that being the immunity argument, right? Whether or not President Trump enjoys immunity for things that he did while he was in office.
You mentioned Arizona there, and just today authorities have revealed the conspiracy, fraud and forgery charges against a former aide and four attorneys in the fake elector case. But the names of Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, and Rudy Giuliani remained blacked out Forgive my ignorance, Michael. What is all this relating to? Is it to going back to the 2020 election?
Yes, it's all tied to the 2020 election. And really, what is this all about? It's really intended to send a clear message to any lawyer who wants to stand up for the Constitution, the rule of law, and President Trump. And it's to say this is radioactive. This is toxic. Don't go anywhere near this, because if you do, you could find yourself with an ethics complaint, a bar complaint where you lose your ability to practice law, or even in this case, these are felony indictments, right? This is a grand jury indictment in the state of Arizona for crimes. So they're now accusing them of crimes. That's really what this case is all about. They're all show trials, whether we're talking New York, Arizona, Jack Smith's prosecution, right? It's all for show. And really, the ultimate goal is to keep President Trump tied up in courtrooms and litigation, because every dollar that he spends on legal defense and every day he spends in court is money and time that he cannot spend on the campaign trail. And that's exactly what President Biden's supporters want. They want to be able to point to President Trump and the legal issues that he has to deal with and confront every single day, so that they can distract from Joe Biden's absolute failures as a president, and his failure to secure the border, his failure to get the economy under control, his failure to get violent crime under control. We've got protests running rampant across this country on college campuses and elsewhere, and they're doing absolutely nothing to stop it. And all they want to talk about is President Trump and his trials.
This all goes back to the 2020 election and the 11 Arizona Republicans who supposedly submitted a document to Congress falsely declaring that Trump won in Arizona in 2020. As far as I'm concerned, he did win in Arizona in 2020, didn't he?
Yeah, it certainly appears that way, right? I mean, I guess, you know, most people are now, I think, looking ahead to November of 2024. We're only, less than 200 days away from that. I think there's still a lot of frustration about what happened in 2020. Millions of Americans feel that the election was taken, that the White House was taken. But it's sort of like, okay, then let's not let this happen again, right? Let's ensure that we turn out the vote, that Republicans show up in force, and that we ensure that our voices are heard. And that includes a lot of efforts on the ground in the United States, we should ensure that voting is easy, but cheating is hard, if not impossible. And so that's one of the things that we're doing at America First Policy Institute is helping to ensure that voting is easy, but cheating is hard, because we just want to see fair fights and fair elections. And then what's crazy to me is that we continue to run into opposition in places like Arizona. We actually have litigation in Arizona as we speak to try to clean up some of the lack of election integrity that's happening there. And yet we face rampant opposition every single day to our efforts just to ensure that we have election integrity, so that the American people can have confidence in their elections and we don't run into a situation like we did in 2020 all over again.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about the America First Policy Institute, but first we've got to take a very short break with the network. When we come back, Michael Berry will rejoin us for a deeper dive into how Trump can possibly win in 2024 with the deck rigged against him. We'll be right back.
TNT's Chris Smith.
There should be a maintenance of free speech, and we shouldn't have to risk free speech because we are unable to handle someone's criticism or can't handle someone else's news story that happens to be violent. We've long since been desensitized by this stuff. Now, whether that's a good thing, I'm not saying whether it's a good thing. Whether it's a bad thing, I'm not saying that either. It's what we have been used to. But in countries like Australia right now, they are pulling certain news pieces, footage that we would normally see, they're pulling that footage from social media, or they'll find the social media platforms $785,000 a day.
Chris Smith on today's News Talk, TNT. TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do. Crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
At the top of the hour, we'll keep on top of the news.
It's the most important thing we can do.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
We are indeed the home of free speech here on today's News Talk. And for some people, extraordinarily in 2024, that's controversial. One person for whom it most definitely is not controversial, and I hope and believe you're a staunch defender of the First Amendment, is my guest, Michael Berry, who joins me on the line now. Michael, the America First Policy Institute. Can you tell us more about it, and are you indeed committed to defending the Constitution?
Well, the answer to your second question is unequivocally and absolutely yes. That's what we exist to do, is to defend the most fundamental rights of all Americans. And the America First Policy Institute is a national think tank based in Washington, D.C. We are a policy think tank. And we have 23 different policy centers. So, I mean, everything from, the rule of law and criminal justice. We have a center for American values, a center for the American worker. Of course, the center that I oversee as executive director is the Center for Litigation. And so this is really a quite a robust effort to ensure that we present the best and strongest America First policies and agendas to the American people, so that we can ensure that the America First agenda continues to live on for the next 100 years, so that America remains the beacon of light and hope to the world that it has been. This nation has been so blessed, and as an American, as a first generation, son of an immigrant, it's a huge blessing to me to be able to say that I'm an American citizen, and I want to see the liberties and the values that have made America what it is. I want to see those passed on to my kids and my grandkids, and so that's what America First Policy Institute is all about.
Putting on for $2 million in debt, the federal government, and while China has built thousands of miles of high-speed rail, infrastructure in the United States appears to be falling far behind the Far East and other parts of the world. What is your institute's position on how to improve and modernize what's now generally called the homeland?
Well, look, it starts with, it's in our name, right? America First. We need to bring a lot of the jobs and infrastructure jobs back home to America. We need to put American workers back to work and stop outsourcing and sending a lot of our jobs overseas. But we also, I think one of the more important things to do is, as President Reagan famously, he said the nine most frightening words in the English language are from, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." I think we need to, a lot of times, get government out of the way, right? Now, I will caveat that by saying it's important to partner with the government. The government serves an important role and function in everyday life. But if you let the government take over everything, I think that's what leads to some of these outcomes that we're seeing now, and why nations like China that you mentioned are starting to catch up, or in some circumstances to edge out ahead. So we need to get back to common sense policies that put America first. I mean, look, another very easy concrete example is our border, right? Especially our southern border. It's wide open. We've had, during the Biden administration, more than 11 million illegal aliens have either crossed our border and been captured or have been released. And, that's that's just an unacceptable, intolerable number of people that have crossed into our country illegally. If you don't have a border, you don't have a country. So let's start by ensuring that we have a secure border. That's what places, that puts America and Americans first. It will help stem or even stop the tide of human trafficking, of fentanyl that's coming into our country, right? So that, and all these things tie together. You want a strong economy? Have a strong border. You want a strong border? Have a strong economy, right? Ensure that Americans are have the best jobs, that our economy is healthy and strong, that crime is low. So that's what we're trying to do at America First Policy Institute.
And are you endorsing particular candidates, raising money, acting as a super PAC in some way? Because an awful lot of Republican candidates are what people call rhinos, Republicans in name only. America First, but $86 billion is on its way to Ukraine.
No, we are a 501c3. So for those who aren't familiar with that term, that means we are a tax exempt under the IRS code. And so we don't endorse. We are actually bipartisan or nonpartisan, really. And that means that we'll work with anybody. And I'll be the first to say, like, as executive director of litigation, you know, I'll represent anybody on either side, as long as what they stand for is consistent with the America First mission, right? Which is to ensure that that every policy that we advance places America and Americans first. And if that's the case, we're happy to work with you. We're happy to represent you. But no, we don't endorse any particular side or candidate.
On the domestic front, you know, as you said, I mean, I remember Ross Perot saying there's going to be a giant sucking sound about all the jobs going abroad. But, you know, I'd love to see American manufacturing have a revival. How on earth are you going to bring that about, though, with the way the current trade arrangements are?
Well, I mean, look, there's some concrete examples of things that we can stop with some of the, we can start putting common sense first, right? Stop with things like this EV push that the Biden administration is pushing, which is artificially propping up the EV industry and the EV market. And they're trying, I mean, and again, it doesn't make sense. The numbers don't add up. They keep talking about needing to do it in order to protect the environment because climate change is the number one priority for the administration. But then when you just scratch beneath the surface, you see that there isn't an organic market for electric vehicles. Americans still like their gas-powered automobiles. And guess what? These EVs, these batteries, the rare earth metals that they need in order to create these batteries are doing more harm than good to our environment. They're wiping out entire, you know, ecosystems just to be able to produce the rare earth metals that are needed for these batteries. And so, again, it's just we need to allow common sense prevail. And in many instances, that's free market capitalism, right? I mean, it's one of the greatest drivers of innovation, of advancement. That's what America used to be known for. It used to be the pride and joy, right, of American innovation, and now it's being stifled. Because you have, going back to the point I just made, you have the government stepping in and saying, we know better than everyone else. We have an agenda. We need to ensure that we advance our agenda. And so we're going to artificially meddle in these markets, whether it's the EV market, the oil and gas industry, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what's creating these devastating consequences for everyday Americans to where they're no longer, or many of them are no longer able to afford, you know, the types of vehicles that they used to be able to buy to pay for the price of gas, the price of just groceries. I saw a recent survey where they asked people, you know, to go to the grocery store, put a normal week's worth of groceries into your shopping cart, add up the price and whatever that was, and then they compared it to 5 years ago and 10 years ago. I mean, and people said, well, no wonder I'm living paycheck to paycheck. And I think more Americans are now living paycheck to paycheck than at any time in recent memory.
Absolutely. I mean, compared to the 1950s when you could buy a house on a single salary. I mean, those were the halcyon days, weren't they? Trump's going to be the nominee. We started talking about Donald Trump. who on earth is going to be his VP? I've seen all sorts of names mentioned from, Tulsi Gabbard on the one hand to Tim Scott. And who's the other chap? Ben Carson. Is your organization backing anyone in particular? Who would you like to see as his running mate?
No, you know, we don't necessarily endorse anyone. We're watching with watchful eyes, just like everyone else is, very curious. I do think that at the end of the day, President Trump has pretty good instincts, and he's probably going to follow his instincts. I don't know who is advising him directly on that, but I do suspect it is somebody who he believes will, help him win in November, but then also be able to carry the baton forward. Because if and when President Trump wins in November, right, I mean, it will be his second term. And so he'll have to pass the torch and pass the baton to someone else. And so I think that's a big part of the criteria. And I think that's something that American people are very mindful of as well. They want to know who is it that is best situated to bring America into really the middle part of the 21st century. So I, along with the rest of the watching world, am very, very curious and anxious to see exactly who President Trump picks.
Well, with that in mind, let's just hope it isn't Nikki Haley. That's my two cents worth. Michael Berry, thank you so much for joining us tonight on today's News Talk.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. There he goes. That's Michael Berry of the America First Policy Institute. We're going to take a very short break now. And when we come back, I'll be joined by TNT contributor and investigative journalist Christian James for more of today's news. We'll find out what he's been ferreting out after this short break.
While serving in Vietnam, a grenade took my ability to see. Today, I'm a sculptor creating new visions. Now, my fingers are my eyes. As a veteran, I know the challenges of life can be great. In my art, turning a lump of clay into something beautiful, that means a lot to me. Life is like that. We each must use what we can to make things better.
DAV helps veterans like Michael get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
Now, I show others how they can create something with their own hands. With support from DAV, more veterans can shape their lives into a thing of beauty. My victory is bringing beauty into the world.
Michael Naranjo, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
We come from a long line of farmers, and there's a sense of pride. But there's also a significant amount of pressure.
Farmers have to take care of their physical and their mental health, because what's a farm without a farmer?
Watching the sun come up, that's my time. I can have a cup of coffee and every day is a new opportunity.
That's cool.
Your hands got so
cool. Yay!
Don't forget to check in on yourself. Love your mind.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
And welcome back to the Patrick Henningsen Show with me, Basil Valentine, in for Patrick. Today, Friday, the 26th of April, 2024. We're into the final segment, and I'm delighted to say I'm joined by TNT contributor and investigative journalist Christian James. Welcome to the program, Christian.
Thank you very much for having me here again, Basil. It's been a while since I've been on Patrick Henningsen's show. It's been like a couple of months now, I guess. So I've been getting kind of comfortable with Rick Mutton, and here I am back here for you. And so good to be here.
And you're very welcome. We spoke very briefly during the break there. Europe, we're no longer part of it, but it still affects us. And of course, there are elections to the European Parliament in this year of elections, with the established parties running scared of both the far right and the far left. Supposedly, some tremendous immigration reform was passed after literally years of deliberations. Can you tell us about that, what the prospects are for the election, and any other legislation making its way through Strasbourg and Brussels that may affect us in the future?
Well, I mean, ultimately, the what will be the parliamentary elections comes to us in June. So there's the countdown now to get everything sorted, get everyone voted, find out where everyone is and what everyone's talking about. Of course, over the last 2 months, they have been breaking down what is the key arguments that people are talking about and what they've actually discovered, according to Politico and according to Euroactive, in terms of the their user base, is that Europe has discovered their main issue, in fact, is not immigration. It is, in fact, the Gen Z topics of climate change, of net zero, pushing towards the economy, pushing towards job creation, social exclusion, and public health. And number 10 is immigration. That's much further down than even they expected. So, but ultimately, when it comes to the voting day, of course, I think you're going to see a turnout of lots of different kinds of people. Instead of the people that are polling, pollings are notoriously always out of focus because they're only talking to their politically active people. Unfortunately, what happens is that when it comes to the general consensus, the general amount of people, their views are much wider, and they have issues that are bothering them on a day-to-day basis. They have issues that are they can see in their environment, their friends, their family, their work colleagues, the economy, when it comes to how much money they've got in their pocket. They are the key issues that people want to vote about. And I guess immigration is in there. It is one of those topics that, unfortunately, because it is such a hotbed topic, it's not widely talked about because you have to talk about it in hushed tones because we don't like these people coming over here. We don't like what they're doing to our economy. And I mean, ultimately, I've been focused mainly on the farmers' protests, been talking to those farmers across Europe and what their issues are and what they've been focused on. Of course, one of the key issues that came out of that, which I reported on 21st Century Wire, is, of course, is the subsidy market. What's happening in the Ukraine as well with their ability to sell their goods to Europe at a much cheaper rate, undercutting most of Europe. And when it just comes to the markets and how the traders and the market traders and into business have actually now almost collapsed in certain areas just because certain areas, certain import stock that has come in basically bypasses them, undercuts them, and that has been a key issue on the minds of many farmers over the course of the last 2 months. But right now, Europe is trying to placate to those very people. It's now pushing towards how do you put it? How to balance the needs of the people. As of course we have seen now for around 6 to 8 months, we've seen farmers protest, dumping everything from manure, spraying the parliamentary buildings, graffiti everywhere, massive lines of tractors, massive lines of vehicles, going up to their parliamentary buildings going saying, hey, what you are doing in terms of your legislation, we don't like it. It is affecting us. We understand that there's critical infrastructure that is facing demise. We have seen also new legislation in regards to new bracketing in terms of what is considered to be a small and medium and a large size farm. Their agriculture, their rotas, their quotas have been cut drastically. What used to be a small farm used to be if you had more than around 200 animals. Now it's now says it's 100. So if you have 100 animals, you're now considered a medium to large size farm. You have higher taxes coming in. But over this yesterday, I believe it was, or Monday, they have agreed to drop them barriers, those quotas entirely, just to placate these farmers to make this. We want your vote. We need to make this happen because, of course, like you said, there, the far right, the far left, all the different parties in between are vying for those key votes to come in, and ultimately, so this has to happen. So what's happening now is you're having a lot of what used to be red tape, lots of bargaining, lots of to and fro between parliamentary groups and committees is now kind of just being shed away just because ultimately they need to get the vote in their camp.
All right. You know, there's this big sort of centre-right bloc, the Christian Democrats that the UK Conservatives used to sit with. Then there's your traditional sort of centre-left bloc. Both of those are really sort of globalist, warmongering, the neocon type foreign policy groups. And then you've got the likes of Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, who I see a lot of on the X platform, speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. But they seem to have very limited influence. Ursula von der Leyen sits there with a smug grin on her face while she's called out for her role in the genocide. Is there any chance of the European elections this June throwing up a different EU foreign policy?
That's a very good point, actually, because, of course, when it comes to European foreign policy, they've got to deal with the Moida discussions. What are we going to do with Turkey? Are they going to press into the EU? Is it going to be what's their deal with Ukraine? What's the deal with Russia right now? Them topics are ultimately the battleground of every parliament circle right now, is how do we deal with these issues? How are we going to deal with importing and exporting of stock and goods and agriculture? What's the economic situation? How is inflation going to be? Ursula von der Leyen certainly finds herself in the firing line of all those situations. I can't imagine it's a very comfortable position. I think what's going to happen with her position? I think she may lose a lot of points. I don't think she'll lose her seat, as it were, because she clearly sits in those kind of globalist positions. She clearly has a lot of backing from a lot of organizations, the public-private partnership organizations. They clearly want to keep these people in power. They're well-funded. These organizations will do what they can to convince their voter base to make sure they still vote for these organizations. So they still play a major part. Ultimately, the European Parliament is still kind of functioned by the two major political parties. I think you're going to find the SPP. They'll still stay in position. But I don't know. It's going to be really interesting. I mean, that, to my understanding, and I might be slightly wrong with this, I think they're now opening up how many seats they have. I think currently the European Parliament is made up by 705 seats. And I believe that's actually going up to 720 this year. And there's going to be a bit of a realignment when it comes to how many seats per country they can have in. I think currently it's a maximum of 6. I do believe that's going to go up to 8. So there's more voices now on the European Parliament floor. So it's all going to be a bit of a change this time round.
Is it not the case that really Europe is simply too large and too diverse to have a single parliament? I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, in over 50 years, what has the European Parliament actually achieved?
That's a very good question. What has the European Parliament ultimately achieved? I guess the idea of having a free trade zone between each country, having the ability to move cultural, you know, you can travel from France and go all the way across to Moldova, and there's no restrictions upon doing so. You don't need your passport, etc. But these are almost like trade agreements, movement agreements, rather than anything beyond that. But I think the European Union's sphere of influence, of course, wants to ultimately capture as many groups of countries into its sphere of influence as possible. There's even talk of like Cyprus now moving into that as well. So who knows what their plan is for the future, other than perhaps is to control us and make sure they know what we're doing. I did see a couple of days ago a new EU-wide digital passport is about to be rolled out. That's coming out towards the end of the year. I think it's set for August, September, where you can have, basically, it's a digital passport on your phone that will also be your health insurance will also be judged and tracked through that. So the idea is you could go anywhere and all be... your health could be taken care of. For instance, you could buy it through the app, you'd buy your travel through the app. And we all know where the big brother system potentially could come into that. There's certainly conspiracy talking about those kind of topics, about a top-down control method, about idea of people surveillance. Whether it actually comes to that, I don't think so. But ultimately, those technologies are about to roll out across all of the EU. So who knows?
I'm seeing an article on Euronews. How is Europe preparing for possible disinformation campaigns with respect to the elections? Concerns are growing. I didn't know that concerns could actually, you know, had they had an organic life of their own and they were capable of growing. But anyway, growing regarding disinformation and artificial intelligence generated content ahead of the EU elections in June. We're not going to see the usual garbage about Russian and Chinese interference, are we? Or that somehow sharing of information on social media is somehow a threat to democracy. But the EU has got a nasty authoritarian streak to it.
For sure. I mean, from a top-down perspective, they want the ability to control information, who talks about what, and where they talk about it. I mean, so looking here across Euroactive, the European Parliament there wishes to give a final nod to loosen green requirements. Again, just tapping into the pharma topic there. So the idea is you have new legislative processes that are being fast-tracked through in order to make sure that votes go their way, to bring votes away from Le Pen, for instance, and away from the Socialists and Democrats and the Greens. And so it's that they're fast-tracking agreements to go through Parliament quickly so people don't vote for those fringe outer parties, as it were, so they don't have more seats on the ground in the European Parliament. So I think they're going to try and appease everybody. I think a lot's going to squeeze through. A lot of things are going to be simplified to be voted through quickly and to say, hey, we're doing a great job. Please vote for us. This is our thing, and we see your future as our future. You know, the kind of common purpose talk that we've all heard of.
Yes, absolutely. It's to be hoped that the monopoly in the European Union after these elections of the globalists is to be broken up. They're all terrified of populism. In other words, people voting outside the acceptable narrow opinion corridor, whether that be for leftists like Mick Wallace and Claire Daly, or on the other hand, the so-called far right, the likes of Christine Friedland, who has led the charge against vaccine mandates. We're no longer part of it in Britain, but have you any idea what the polls are suggesting? We know that, you know, Macron is particularly unpopular at the moment. I don't think Schultz is doing very well either in Germany as well. But of course, there are so many more countries in Europe than that.
Well, according to the European Parliament election poll of polls presently being hosted by Politico, it shows that the EPP obviously sits to gain the most positions at 175 and the Social Democrats at 138. So they will still lead the majority of the polls in terms of the predictions that people have voted for so far. But there is a significant move by the ECR and the Greens, Northern Ireland Alliance. Of course, they're moving up the left. You know, it still sits with a significant margin, you know, above over its former position before. So we're now going to see a 10-point average, it says here, across all the non-affiliated, non-mainstream parties. So I think we will find there'll be more seats for everyone, more things talking about, which can only be a good thing. I mean, in the UK, of course, we face the situation where all the parties beyond Labour and the Conservatives don't even have a voice. I'm sure they're talking. I'm sure the Liberal Democrats are still there. Surely the Greens are still there and the SUP and so on. But ultimately, you only ever hear the two sides of the aisle about what's happening in Parliament. Essentially, in the European Parliament, it's the same kind of situation.
Of course, Ireland is still in the European Union, and Scotland would like to rejoin it should they be granted independence. But they've got enough problems up there at the moment without that. Hamza Yousaf fighting for his political life after the collapse of the coalition with the Greens. Have you been looking at what's going on north of the border at all, Christian?
Yeah, normally I have. Normally that has been. I've got some friends who live in Scotland, and they will constantly bombard me with new news from Scotland. To my understanding, I did see some tweets today, X's, whatever they're called now, that he had resigned. But there's since been data that shows that he hasn't, and that's misinformation. That's right. So I guess we can all be informed of misinformation. So I saw that and I was like, I need to check more into this. I can't say I have. I know that he's found himself in hot water in every position that he's had, from transport minister to health minister. He's always faced a scandal in every one of these positions. And here it seems to be no different. Here he is as the First Minister of Scotland and in hot water. He hasn't been in the job 6 months and he's already on his way out.
Absolutely. Of course, the SNP, mired by corruption allegations swirling around the husband of the former First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, and they look set to be wiped out, Yousaf hanging on to his job, because if the Labour vote of no confidence in the Scottish government passes with a majority in the Parliament at Holyrood, the entire government is forced to resign, and that's almost certain to trigger an election. We've got elections, of course, local elections all over the United Kingdom next week, including Mayor of London. It's widely expected that the Conservative Party are going to be decimated, polling possibly less than 20% nationally. They're talking about record lows and the knives being out for Rishi Sunak in advance of the general election. What chances are there, do you think, Christian, of Sunak being deposed in another typical Tory decapitation of its leader, just as they did with Ted Heath Margaret Thatcher, John Major, and all the others, Michael Howard, Ian Duncan Smith. If you don't look like you're going to win an election, your head's on the block.
It is. Their head will often fall into the basket, and the Tories will find themselves chopped away, and then they become the opposition. And I think it's interesting that when they play in opposition position, they tend to get a lot of wide-bid support because they claim that when they're in that position to be the traditionalist party, those who support the people, despite the fact that they tend to wear the suits and they tend to be more orientated towards big business and more globalism. I very much, in Nottingham, we don't even have a opposite political party here. We only have a Labour government. In fact, the Tories and the Liberal Democrats have entirely dropped away. Reform Party has one seat here. So in our constituency, should we say, we're pretty much lost to a one-party system. It's pretty awful here. To the point, you know, where a few people I know are going, we need to perhaps get together and join a political party. Whether I'm going to do that, I don't know. But it's a bit of a mess. So I think Rishi Sunak is not going to survive this. And just think what's happened in the last week. You have Grant Schnapps, the Minister for the Ministry of Defence. You have Rishi Sunak. They're currently in, I think they're in Germany today. They're in Berlin, signing deals in regards to what they announced on Monday, which of course is this 2.5% increase when it comes to our GDP towards our defence spending. They want to raise something like $285 billion in regards to rearming ourselves, ready for a hot war with Russia, China, and North Korea, and Iran, of course. Which, it's really interesting, because if you look around the world, everywhere and there's a major political party about to leave government, a crisis happens. And we saw it, and we have seen this quite recently in Israel. Just don't forget, in September, widespread across Israel, there was massive protests wanting to kick out Bibi Netanyahu. They wanted him gone. You know, and that miraculously, as terrible as it might seem to say that, there was a situation with Gaza, and now he's in a position now where he's considering himself to be the beginning of the new Messiah. Crazy times. But this has happened all around the world. Whenever a major political party is about to go side by side, it's about to fall away. It's happening in Ukraine. There should, in fact, be their general elections also due to start next month. It's not happening. But the people then jump on board and they show their support for the main political party. They tend to stop their politics going ahead in order to maintain their theatre of war for their situation they are currently in. Will we see that happen here before a general election? I don't know, but we now find ourselves in a multi-spectrum warfare situation with those countries because we want to be. What could we do from their position? What would they like to do? Would they like to cause a hot war situation just to stay in power? I don't know. Would they do that? Potentially, because they've seen the worldwide success that it has to stay in power. I think Labour, unfortunately, they are more conservative than conservatives can be right now. Keir Starmer literally is the people's Tory, as they say. And his political position wants to put us back into the EU. So, and all the tragedy that comes with that. So I think we're in for a bumpy ride over the next few months or so. And certainly it keeps us talking. It certainly keeps all the political pundits talking about where this is going to go. The newspapers must be bringing in all their extra staff ready to start talking about these political articles going into the general election here.
Yes, I can remember the war in the Falkland Islands saving Margaret Thatcher's premiership. Mm. She was spectacularly unpopular in the early 1980s, but when Argentina invaded the Falklands and we sent an armada down there to take them back. Suddenly she was hailed as a war hero. Everybody wrapped themselves in the Union Jack and she was elected in 1983. Sunak won't have that luxury. A hot war with Russia or anybody else is going to be far more devastating than a minor skirmish in the South Atlantic. And what's more, I would venture to suggest that the UK establishment is already preparing for a change in the window dressing. It's required every now and then, Christian, to indicate to the populace that, oh, look, you live in a democracy. You've now got a Labour government. It was Conservative, now it's Labour. Blue has turned to red. These two parties are diametrically opposed to each other. And we now see a change in direction, except because there'd be absolutely no change in direction whatsoever under Starmer. He's ditched just about every pledge he made when elected leader of the Labour Party. He is a neoliberal, globalist, warmonger, Zionist, also committed to spending an extra £86 billion on Britain's defence by 2030. That's what it'll cost to increase defence spending to 2.5%, as Sunak has announced and agreed with Scholz. There are, sadly, too many people beating the drums for war, too many talking heads talking about the inevitability of war. Jeremy Corbyn published a terrific piece in The Guardian this week in which he likened the situation to 1914, where an endless series of missteps by leaders took us to a catastrophe that resulted in the loss of millions and millions of lives. It'll only be worse this time round because, of course, of the potential for the use of nuclear weapons. I'm hoping for a political earthquake this year, Christian. Last night on the programme, we had Chris Williamson, deputy leader of the Workers' Party, led by George Galloway, of course, and they have the capacity now to field candidates in every single seat in Britain. That's 650 candidates. I don't think they will. He said they probably won't. But I get the strong impression, and the polls back this up, that people in Britain want a sea change. They don't want this charade of simply replacing one deep state operative in Sunak with another one in Starmer, with his sort of uni-party androids trotting along behind him. People are very dissatisfied. They're dissatisfied with the direction of the country domestically, with rising prices, privatization, uniquely unpopular. I said to Chris as we came off air last night that the Workers' Party need to emphasize their commitment to renationalization, particularly of water and power policies, which are enormously popular with the electorate, both of which were in the last Labour manifesto, both of which have been ditched by Starmer already. People are desperate for peace and prosperity, and the two main parties offer them war and austerity. So what do you think, Christian? Could we see, in spite of our first-past-the-post system and the horrendously biased media spewing out propaganda all the time, could we possibly see a genuine second English revolution?
I like the how you put that, a second English revolution. That very well could happen. An earthquake could happen. I think that if you're of a certain age group, of course, you and I perhaps are included in that, anything over the age of, say, 25, we have seen the country go to the dogs, effectively. You don't have to go to every city or town across the country, all the coastal sides, the English Riviera. It's all falling apart. People are disillusioned. People are upset. Everyone knows someone now who is almost in a position of poverty. And it's very difficult. People want to see a political change from the top down, effectively. They don't want to see it batting between red and blue, you know, between Labour and Conservative. They really do want to see people they know, people they feel represent them, in a position of power to make a difference for those people. To bring back jobs, I guess, is the best phrase that people want to see. But an economy does need good business people. Who are those people? We don't know. You know, are the people who are currently in those positions, the net zero minister, for instance, our Ministry of Defence, their positions, they're talking about the creation of jobs in the military. We just heard Rishi Sunak talk a couple of days ago that they're going to shed 72,000 jobs in the civil service or to pay for their war. So I think these are the reasons, these are the things that people are talking about. And I do think they'll vote with their feet. I think they will go, you know what, we need a third option. You know, like in America, they need a third option from their Republican, Democrat quandary. I think it won't will happen here. And I do believe that they'll do all they can to squash any kinds of third position opposition. But I think it needs to happen. That earthquake in politics does need to rise up. And as soon as people vote with a photo ID, I think it might happen.
Yes, it's certainly a big year for elections in Europe, the United States, Britain, likely in Scotland. And we can only hope we see a new generation of leadership emerge which is more committed to answering the requirements and wishes of the people who represent them, rather than the special interest groups that have taken over legislatures all around the world. Christian James, thank you so much for joining us tonight on TNT Radio. I'm Basil Valentine. I do hope you've enjoyed my sitting in for Patrick this week. He's off on his James Bond adventures, I know not where, international man of mystery that he is. But I'm led to believe he will be back on Monday, back in the hot seat, and I will doubtless be his guest next week here on Today's News Talk. Have a wonderful weekend wherever you are in the world, and see you all very, very soon. I'm Basil Valentine saying thank you and goodbye for now.